Two Bars World Fuck Up with Joe Forrester and Hannah East.
Hello, I'm Joe Forrester and welcome to FUBAR's World Fuck Up, the show that's less reliable than FIFA's officials at the World Cup quarterfinals. Still bitter. And it's a sad day for England, as football's not coming home, but at least Dave the Cat is. As France edged the Three Lions out of yet another tournament. Meanwhile, 5'7" Leo Messi tries to pick a fight with 6'6" Dutchman, who simply wanted to swap shirts with him. Ronaldo walks away from his World Cup dream in tears, and the Moroccans rock on, becoming the first African team to reach a World Cup semi-final. Coming up on today's show, no guest at the top. We'll explain that in a minute. But we are going to be talking Portugal with Aaron Barton, who's a journalist. An English journalist based in Portugal. I believe I've said that correctly. We're also going to be talking women's rights in Qatar in the big conversation today with Louise Donovan and Rothna Begum. Going to be doing World Cup's funniest moments, of course. And in Tell Me Something I Don't Know, we're going to be looking at the world of technology with Dr. Ryan Beale. There you go. I don't trust technology, Hannah. The robots are taking over. How are you doing, Hannah?
I'm all right, Joe. Feeling a bit sad. We're a bit unhappy, aren't we? Because of obviously England have finished their time in the tournament, which I just feel we have to say was completely unfair. That referee was a shocker, disgusting. It was just so frustrating to watch, especially because I had to sit at a wedding. My cousin got married on Saturday and I had to sit with 40 Leeds fans watching the game. And it highlighted to me, Leeds fans are very unique, aren't they? Mm. And I forgot. I know how there's a lot of rivalry with Man United, but they were literally like, oh, I'd rather be a Leeds fan than a United fan. They're scum. And I didn't tell anybody I was a United fan. And then right at the very end, my husband was like, Hannah works on MUTV, you know, we've got season tickets. Ruined it. I just got slated.
Also, it's like, lads, let's put it aside for the next 90 minutes because we're all England fans.
Yeah.
Like, that is one thing I will not tolerate at a World Cup. Or at European Championships when people start to like bring club rival and try and give you like a bit of club banter chat. Yeah. It's like, not now.
Yeah.
There's plenty of time to hate you for the rest of the season. Yeah. Let's just all enjoy being. I think that's why I think the hardest thing about going out of a tournament is that huge amount of national unity and that amazing, like magical feeling where for once you're all on the same side.
Yes.
It just goes in a second. As that ball sails over the bar, it disappears.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is so heartbreaking. And I think that's the magic and kind of the misery of like top flight sport is like things just change in a second. And you get those images of like Harry Kane basically devastated, weeping on the floor. And in the background, the French players all running off in celebration. And it's like that coin toss that just happens. And it's such random chance. And like,
You feel like you're very unfairly treated, which I think 100%
were.
And I'd argue that all day long. I'd turn into the equivalent of a Leeds fan. But also, how do you feel about Harry Kane? Because obviously the situation with him missing the second penalty, how do you feel about that as a Spurs fan?
I genuinely think that out of all of the footballers in the world, to take a high pressure penalty in a World Cup quarterfinal, he is one of two, maybe three footballers who you would want to take that penalty.
Yeah.
He is a world-class centre forward, brilliant under pressure, but it just shows what being under immense pressure can do. Because even a player of that level with kind of that steel, that determination, he's got ice in his veins. I mean, I remember seeing him he missed a penalty away at Anfield. Yeah. And then we got another one in the 94th minute in front of the cop that was going to make it 2-2. And he stepped up and took it again with all the Liverpool fans behind going mad and he scored. And it's like, that's like, he could handle that pressure, but it just shows what a different level of World Cup is. And I genuinely don't blame him at all. I think as devastated as I was, I thought, I can't imagine how he feels. Like, it would just be pure. His whole life is built to that moment.
Joe, like, I know you get really passionate and take it really serious. You're like, well, I know how I felt. So it must be like how Harry Kane felt.
Yeah.
You're comparing your feelings to how Harry Kane felt when he missed the second
England
penalty.
England captain. Harry Kane's just like, oh, do you know what? I'm not that bothered, but I hope Joe's all right.
Where's Joe? It's in a pub somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, Joe's only had 6 pints. He might be a bit upset.
Yeah, he might cry. He's a Spurs fan, you know.
But no, I don't blame him at all. And I think he's like a model professional. And I think he's a great role model, I think, as well. Like, very focused, very professional, down to earth, like, cool, normal guy. And I feel really sorry for him. And do you know what? I don't blame France for essentially seeing how many times they could kick Bukayo Saka and he still lives.
Like, we were messaging like, about this in our chat, weren't we? He got absolutely battered, didn't he? Like, the poor guy, every time you saw him, he's like, and Harry Kane early on in the box when he went down, literally smashed his forehead on the floor, on the grass. But it like came up, he had these like purple bruised like lumps on his head. And you're like Saka didn't even seem to complain, did he? At all. He just took it. He just got back up and carried on.
I don't mind France doing that. That's a legitimate tactic. Fine. But what I do mind is the referee not punishing it. That's it's France's job to disrupt us. That's fine, right? They did their bit. No problem with that. But then it's the ref's job when somebody hits Bukayo Saka with a cricket bat to go, no, well, sorry, I am going to have to stop you there.
Because that's actually not kind. That's not kind hands.
You've literally just run him over with a bus. So you can't do that. It's a football. But honestly, like, because Southgate took him off, I thought, because he probably can't walk. Kicked out of
him. The whole thing, like, with the ref just ignoring all the like violence was literally like a night out in Scarborough, honestly. Yeah. Nothing happens. Everyone just goes, oh, you're all right, mate. Get back up again. Yeah. Like, literally just knocked me out.
But
right?
Gary's on fire. No, he's fine. It's fine. They've got some water in Chippy.
Yeah, he's not breathing. He'll be all right.
But yeah, devastated. I think it was like, given that the draw has opened up a little bit and it would have been Morocco next. Obviously, they've put Portugal and Spain out, so they're obviously quite good as well. But it does feel like a missed opportunity. It feels like a great England team.
We were the better team. And this is all the questions now are asked about Gareth Southgate. I think what he's done in his reign as the England manager, I think he's been incredible. And I'd be devastated if he didn't continue after Euros.
Would you like to hear a stat, Hannah?
I would bloody love to hear a stat.
England have won 6 knockout games in major tournaments between 1968 and 2016. Gareth Southgate has won 6 knockout games between 2018 and 2022. So he's after Alf Ramsey winning the World Cup, he is the most successful England manager. Yeah. So, and I think there's stuff that people have said. Henry Winter from The Times, Mike, who we work with on Rose Ed, shared it and was just like saying, oh, there needs to be an inquest into the defeat. And it's just like, fuck off.
I kind of agree. It's not going to change anything.
But it's like, but we didn't do anything wrong. We outplayed the world champions and the referee gave us nothing. And a world-class centre-forward who you'd want to take your penalties missed a penalty. It was just a crappy day.
It was
a crappy, unlucky day for England. But Hannah, I tell you what wasn't crappy.
You've been
to see your kids' nativity, haven't you? How was it?
I have. Well, they're not going to be actors. I know that. My youngest was a sheep and he like built it up as if he was going to be like, you know, Tom Cruise.
Like he was a young Robert De Niro.
Yeah. He literally had, if you visualize a 4-year-old that's the size of like a 2-year-old, like half a pound wet through, and he had this big fluffy like suit on with like cotton wool balls everywhere. And then this massive hat that was really itching his head and he hates getting his hair cut. So when he gets hair on his neck, he's like, ugh, and doesn't like it. And he had to keep this hat on for half an hour. And I was like, this isn't going to go down well with these massive floppy ears either side of his face. And when he saw me there, he was like so overexcited. I wasn't sure if he was maybe going to wee himself because he was holding his winky for half the performance. And I was like, please don't wet you. And then he had to do half the routine and spin around. And then he was so excited, he forgot it. And then he just laid on all fours in front of everybody. And you could see the teachers probably at the end of term. She's probably really excited to go out with the mates and have a few gins next week. And she just wants this to be over. She was like, shape, come on. And my little boy just didn't understand. And he just stared at me. So the head teacher at the end of the performance was like, you know, some kids might be in the West End one day. And 3 or 4 parents looked at me and they were like, that, not your kid.
Only like, if he's on a bus going through it.
Yeah.
I was in the nativity when I was at
last
school
last week. But grabbing yourself, awkward.
And please sit down. No, but I was like six or whatever. And it was quite like a confusing nativity, because I think it was the early 90s, obviously. So they were trying to be like inclusive and stuff, but it was the 90s. So they got it a bit wrong. And basically, like, all of the children in the class that came from different ethnic backgrounds, they thought it would be a good idea to give them the flags of the country of their heritage so they could wave it during the nativity. I don't remember that bit in the Bible where there's like a lad from like Lithuania, someone from Bangladesh going, oh yeah, like, so I'm part Indian, right? So, and my Indian granddad had come to see this performance with my mum. So he was Indian, he was a Hindu. He was ever so excited. And I don't think he knew about this. So I was given a flag to wave, which what should have been a very proud moment. Sadly, they gave me a Sri Lankan flag.
Well, it was the 1990s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the 90s. So that's ballpark, isn't it, mate? Go on and wave that, and then we'll knock off Danabooza. Like, literally, I was like, I love, they're trying to help, but what they've done there is there's a 70-year-old man there who's like, oh, that is quite offensive because we're different countries. He didn't care at all. He loved it. It was a nice day out.
And then you just stood there, played with yourself and wet yourself. But Joe, let's talk about where you're watching the rest of the World Cup matches. Have you still got all your reservations in all the different pubs, or have you cancelled them?
I've cancelled them.
Are you done with the World Cup now? No.
I'll watch it. I'll still watch it, but I'm not going to the pub. I'm not gonna give the French the satisfaction of spending money on expensive lager in the pub. They don't deserve it. But basically now, all I really want out of life is to see France get knocked out and Kylian Mbappe cry. That's basically my life's purpose.
What did you make of him and how he reacted?
I think it's absolutely fair enough to celebrate. I get
but
it.
But laughing.
Yeah, that's...
Because he laughed, didn't he, at Harry Kane when he missed?
Yeah, that's something else. And if you look at people like Olivia Giroud, for example, who were pretty magnanimous and kind of graceful, and like made a big point, and Deschamps, so the England, France manager, did it, like made a point of going to see the England players and basically like shaking hands, hugging them or whatever, like, which is the right thing to do. Like, it's the classy thing to do, but he's just a bell end, isn't he?
Yeah.
So he's a total bell end. He basically just thinks he's God. And annoyingly, he's really good at football because he's got that ego, but he's brilliant at football.
Well, it's like people say about Ronaldo, isn't it? There's this huge debate at the wedding as the Leeds fans were like, oh, Ronaldo, he's this, he's that. And they're like, oh, he's so arrogant. He thinks he's so up himself. And he thinks he's, when they were talking in his interview, when he's talking about Wayne Rooney, and he's like, oh, you know, I'm better looking and all this stuff. And I'm just like,
obviously,
it is kind of actually correct. Like, he doesn't have to tell people that, and you don't have to disagree as if he isn't, or question that that's a silly question to ask in the first place. But it's like, well, of course, when you're a top flight athlete and you're the best in the world, you have to be arrogant. Otherwise, you're never going to believe you're going to be the best. And then you're probably not going to be the best. It's just like, I hate this whole Ronaldo train at the moment. I find it really irritating.
I kind of do think that it's like those people like Ronaldo, people like Michael Jordan, whatever. Yeah. What makes you amazing also makes you pretty fundamentally unpleasant to be around.
Yeah. Well, it's like Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He can say what he wants, where he's like, I am the best. And until somebody is better than me, then I'll retire. But until that point, I'll keep going. And it's like he's quite comical with it. But he means everything he says. He's not just saying it for like a bit of a joke. But because Ronaldo says it and he's a bit younger, and obviously I know there's more to it with Ronaldo.
And he's not funny. He's got no sense of humour whatsoever. But you would kind of get like, I don't know, I think like these people are quite amusing, but you wouldn't want to work in Dixon's with them. You'd be like, he's all right, not bad, isn't he?
Yeah. He's had extra 20 minutes on his lunch break. What a prick.
Zlatan, who does the VCRs, is all right. VCRs, you know, VCRs.
That's something I would say.
But no, do you know what? I'm going to, like, I desperately love the final to be Morocco-Croatia. I think that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
I kind of don't know where I am with it, because I think it would be so cool to see Croatia win a World Cup.
Yeah.
I think they've got a population of 3 million people in Croatia. It's their second World Cup semi-final in a row. They knocked England out of the last World Cup in the semis, absolutely played us off the park. Like, and they've been one of the best teams in the world for 10 years, probably, despite having a tiny population and so little money.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that it'd be lovely to see them do it. But then Morocco are the first African country into a semi-final.
Yeah.
And to see them win a World Cup would be incredible. And also, I think there's something kind of beautiful and cyclical about it, because Pelé is obviously very ill at the moment.
Yeah.
And is in palliative care and essentially doesn't have long left, and is one of the great icons of, well, global football and global sport generally. And he famously said about 40 years ago that he thinks an African team will win the World Cup before the year 2000. Now, that didn't happen, but it might be, I think there's something rather poetic if maybe one of the last things that Pelé was to see after such an amazing life was an African team win a World Cup. I think that would be kind of cool. Right, anyway, so sorry to...
You're very emotional today, Joe, aren't you?
I'm always like this after a tournament. I'm always a bit wobbly. I can't control my emotions properly.
It's like me saying, oh, what do you make of Spurs' performance at the weekend? And then you get really emotional about it.
Yeah.
But this is off the scale for you.
I'm sort of oscillating between like screaming and squealing and singing songs and like really kind of like wistful, thoughtful memories.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Anyway, it's time to move on and let's talk about Portugal. Essentially, the only man who's been more upset at the World Cup this week than Harry Kane was poor old Cristiano Ronaldo. Let's talk Portugal's untimely exit from the World Cup with Aaron Barton, journalist who covers Portuguese football. Aaron, Portugal out of the World Cup, Ronaldo in tears, accusations of match fixing from Pepe, Bruno Fernandes, I've seen so far. What has the fallout and the reaction been from the public?
To be honest, I think in Portugal, I'm back in Portugal, a lot of the focus hasn't really been on the referees. I think it's just an easy thing to go through in the heat of the moment after the match, considering so many of the officials are Argentine and there's all these conspiracy theories. But really, on the day, I think a lot of people accept that Portugal just weren't good enough. And over the course of the tournament, excluding really the Switzerland game, they had to ride the luck at times, and the luck just sort of ran out in the game against Morocco. They were tough to beat. They were tough to break down. And I think no matter the referee and performance, Portugal could still be playing now and they wouldn't have scored. So I think it's a tough one to take, but it is what it is.
I think we're in danger as well of like kind of being people who cover the quite bigger football nations of still being disrespectful to Morocco, because we're like, oh, well, France got Morocco in the semi-finals. Obviously they'll beat them. It's like, well, no, these guys put out Portugal and Spain. So they're a decent side. I mean, I wonder what's the feeling in Portugal about Ronaldo? Really controversial tournament for him. He turned up at the start. It seemed like his teammates didn't really kind of want to fraternize with him, particularly after the interview he gave about United. So there's issues with him and Bruno Fernandes. He's made quite a lot of it about him, as he so often does. Walked down the tunnel in tears. It was hard not to feel sorry for him at that moment as well. Kind of, where are Portuguese football fans on Ronaldo now?
I think, to be honest, a lot of it gets blown out of proportion, especially in England and even in the likes of Spain and France and stuff. Whereas in Portugal, it's covered a little bit differently. It's more of a sadness for him, not just for him. This is the end of an era for so many of the squad. You're looking at the likes of Rui Patricio, didn't get on. Pep is 39. You know, Cristiano's obviously 37. João Moutinho was left out of the tournament. He's another player who probably won't get another cap for Portugal. So it's this sort of spine of the team, not just Cristiano, that it felt like this was kind of last chance saloon, especially at the World Cup. I mean, the Euros is 2 years away, but for the World Cup, that's probably sort of your lot. And I think the feeling in Portugal is that if he continues to play for Portugal, especially when if a new manager comes in, Fernando Santos is expected to be relieved of his duties this week. He's got a meeting in Lisbon this week. Is that if a new manager comes in, he wouldn't be given a starting place to Cristiano anyway. His playing time would be, you know, nowhere near what it has been over the last couple of years, which is expected. And I think his teammates more than anything rallied around him at the end, because they know how much it meant to him. And in terms of, he's always been a record chaser. He's always been someone who wants to cement his legacy. And that's what's probably kept him driving on at 37 years of age, when realistically no other footballer really it seems as motivated as him. Yeah.
And still as passionate now as he was years
back. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it it reminded me of seeing him walking down the tunnel and crying. It reminded me of 2004. I remember watching that game as a child myself, the Euro 2004 final. I was in floods of tears as well. And then watching him walk, it did feel like a sort of an end of a cycle moment. And he then went to Instagram, put a post out and said, it's always been his dream to win the World Cup. Yesterday, that dream was over, which kind of confirms that he won't be, you know, playing at the next World Cup, which no one expected him really to do. I think he'd be 41 at the time. But yeah, it was just a sad moment, to be fair. But as I say, not just for him. I think it was more of a sense of a missed opportunity in Portugal, considering the run and that, you know, this was the first time they even got to the quarterfinals of a World Cup since 2006. Mm. Portugal historically do not do well at World Cups, despite what maybe the quality in the Portugal side would make you think, oh, these are, you know, European heavyweights, worldwide heavyweights, but it's not really been that case. You know, especially in the 20th century, Portugal didn't really do a tap on the international scene, bar 1966 when they reached the semi-final. It's been more this sort of, this crop of players that you thought, if they were ever going to go on and surpass the Euro 2016 or the Nations League in 2019, it'd be round about this time. Lots of players, 27, 28 years of age, and you've got sort of Cristiano and probably what's his last World Cup. It all seemed like if there was ever a time, it'd be now. And unfortunately, you know, it's not the case.
And was there quite a lot of momentum and optimism then for Portugal? Did you really strongly believe that they could have made it all the way?
Yeah. I think the Portuguese people as a whole are usually quite pessimistic, and that's the same when it comes to football. And you know, you sort of go into games negative, despite the fact you look at that starting 11 and you think probably 9 or 10 of them play for, you know, top teams. You know, your Manchester City's, Paris Saint Germain, all those, you know, sort of Champions League fighting clubs. And the group stage didn't really inspire too much. The Ghana game could have easily thrown it away at the end. The Uruguay game was a positive result. Portugal don't do well against South American teams historically. But again, there was a penalty at the end, and you think, oh, on another day, they might have not have, you know, got it. Against Ghana, there was a penalty when Ronaldo went down. You think another referee might not have given that. And then obviously defeat in the last game to South Korea. So it wasn't until really the Switzerland game that we actually saw this sort of swashbuckling Portugal, the likes of João Félix, Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes, all getting on the ball, combining with each other. And you think, this is a serious outfit, this, if they can get this right. But I think a lot of people in Portugal, they didn't underestimate Morocco, because Portugal found it very difficult to play against that type of team. And then after watching the Spain game, or not even the Spain game, after watching, even in the group stage, the game against, I think it was a Belgium, then watching the Spain game, and you think, if you try and dictate possession, that's not going to win you the game. I think Portugal ended up with 70-odd% possession, but Morocco had the better chances, and Morocco, you know, were the ones who actually found the back of the net. So it was just sort of trying to find that cutting edge. I think there'll be a test for anyone, Morocco, to be honest. I think a lot of people are like, oh, you know, France have got a really, really easy game there. But Morocco will just sit back. I think from the ninth or the 10th minute against Portugal, they had 11 men in their half. It's so hard to break down when you're only going forward with 4 or 5 players, because you're leaving players back because of the counter. So you think at all times it's 4 or 5 against 11, basically. Mm. So it's really hard to break down. And you think they've got so many good players in transition, the likes of Amrabat and Ziyech, that can really hurt you on the counter. So yeah, sense of a missed opportunity, but I'd like to see Morocco go on and at least win it and pull off a shock win. Then I can say, well, Portugal got knocked out by the eventual winners.
Yeah. and I think there's an element, I think every England fan is going to be Moroccan as well.
Yeah, I think so.
Nice one, Aaron. Thank you very much for joining us. If you want to learn more about Portuguese football, Aaron Barton UK on Twitter. Also, Proxima Jornada 1. I think I'm saying that right.
That was brilliant, yeah.
Thank you very much.
It's been practicing.
All things Portuguese football. Nice one, Aaron. Thank you very much, mate.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
So it's time for the big conversation. We know this is the bit where we have an in-depth and uncensored chat about the controversies facing this year's World Cup. And today we're going to focus on the treatment of women in Qatar. Since the 90s, women have made significant legal and social advancements. In 1999, women were given the vote for the first time and given the chance to run for office. Labour force participation for women is roughly 51%, which is higher than the global average and is the highest rate in the Arab world. And in 2012, female athletes were sent to compete at the London Olympics, marking some progress for equality. However, the country still enforces a guardianship system, which gives men authority over some of the basic aspects of a woman's life. In Qatar, it's legal to control the whereabouts of a grown woman and enforce curfews. Women cannot be primary guardians of their own children, and an unmarried woman under the age of 25 must legally ask for permission from a guardian in order to leave the country. So we can understand a little bit more about the guardianship system and the challenges women still face in Qatar. Let's speak to some experts. We have Louise Donovan, journalist and reporter at the Fuller Project, and Rothna Begum, senior women's rights researcher at Human Rights Watch. Thank you both very much for joining us. Louise, we'll start with you. There seems to be this kind of strange dichotomy, I suppose, between the legal and social rights that Qatari women are able to enjoy, such as being able to vote or work, and the reality of the situation, which is the guardianship system. What is the real situation and reality for women in Qatar right now?
So I can speak to migrant women specifically, because this is, you know, what I've done reporting and research into. And so for The Guardian, I spoke to women who'd worked in the hotels in Qatar over the last couple of years, mostly as cleaners. And they told me about their experience of sexual harassment as well as physical and verbal abuse. But I think before we get into that, it's just a bit of context about who these women are and why they're in these jobs in the first place, because it often explains why they don't just leave when things get bad. So there's millions of low-paid workers, mostly from Asia and Africa, heading to the Gulf to seek work. You know, this is because there's often few employment opportunities back home. And they often, they're left with not that many choices if they want to make money for their family. Women are particularly, tend to be the main breadwinner for their families. So there's a real fear about losing these jobs that are a lifeline for them. You know, they need them, and they kind of will put up with a lot to keep them. And so through speaking to women, you know, I had kind of a range of issues. One woman was a cleaner in a luxury hotel. She said she was harassed by her male supervisor kind of over an 18-month period. You know, he consistently sexually propositioned her. She repeatedly said no. And in turn, he would punish her, you know, by making her do extra work. She didn't report the issue because she was afraid that she was going to be deported. I spoke to another woman in another luxury hotel. So this time it wasn't her supervisor, it was the actual guests. You know, she's alone in these rooms, these hotel rooms. You know, she's gathering the sheets, she's replacing the toilet. She's just trying to do her job, basically. And when she, so the guy kind of, you know, sexually harassed her. And when she raised the issue, nothing was done. You know, her manager told her she was a woman. She just needs to learn to handle her issues. The second time she reported it, she was basically told by management, you know, be quiet and we're just going to rotate you around. We're going to put someone else, another woman, back into the role that you've just left. And she is now back in Kenya. She refuses to return to Qatar, and she's been, you know, super scarred by this experience. Every time a man gets close, it brings back the memory of what happened in Qatar. You know, and then there's also like sort of verbal and physical violence. You know, a guest, another woman in another luxury hotel said a guest tried to slap her when she reported it. The manager says she shouldn't have been serving him in the first place. And at the end of the day, what I heard from most women that I spoke to, this was the mantra that seemed to be repeated. The guest is always right. You are second, the guest is first, and the guest is always right.
So, Louise, one of the things that I kind of found interesting looking at your research and your work, and the thing that kind of struck me is like you say, when these women report these incidents, they're told they're in the wrong. In to one degree or another, that tends to be the overall outcome. Is there any kind of recourse for these women, anywhere they can go to say that something has happened and that it might be dealt with?
Yeah, it's a good question. Mostly not. And that plays a large part. Firstly, like, you know, they're not reporting because of their kind of like contextual reasons, as they really want to keep their job. And then, you know, secondly, you've got the kafala system. There have been some reforms, but workers have said that, you know, little has changed. Employers have a huge degree still over their lives. And I think very importantly for Qatar, migrant worker unions are banned. So there are actually just few, you know, elsewhere in the world, you can join a union if you have a problem with your employer. And, you know, if you're not getting paid properly, if there's harassment issues, you can sort of collectively gather together and you can try and challenge that and you can try and speak up. Women in Qatar just don't have that option. And there are other issues too. You know, the country's penal code penalizes sex outside of marriage. Mm. So if a woman does decide to report sexual assault, police often don't believe the women. You know, instead, they're siding with men who claim it was consensual, which then can lead to the survivor being prosecuted. You know, any indication that a woman even knew the man is enough to prosecute the woman. And also in Qatar, you know, women also need to show that they are married in order to access certain forms of sexual and reproductive health care. So, you know, if you are sexually attacked or, for example, you know, and you need to go see a doctor and you're not married, you're stuck. You know, this kind of route means that you might not be able to access treatment for sexually transmitted infections and pregnancy, for example. So, yeah, the reality is it's tough and it's. Yeah, it's difficult.
It's like a never-ending kind of battle, because even if they raise issues, as you said, nothing's going to get done about it.
Because yeah, and voices, I think, and also I think the Qatari authorities did introduce an auditing system in the hotel sector to try and, you know, there were workers' rights violations appearing. So they introduced this mechanism of this kind of system where you can try and, you know, they're going in, they're asking questions, and it's a way of trying to flag some of these issues. But the auditing, there's been a lot of work done on the auditing sort of like structure or as a system, and it often just doesn't pick up. It's not picking up problems enough. You know, that's because it's often relying on a specific time. You know, people are going into these hotels to ask questions at a specific time, so there might not be everyone around.
Yeah,
some workers are coaxed into saying things. Like in the past, they have been. And the other thing with those auditing systems is that actually it is very bad. Rights groups say it, picking up sexual harassment. You know, women are just they're not inclined to report something as sensitive and often stigmatized as harassment via a kind of, you know, a corporate reporting mechanism. So
because you're going to lose your job basically if you do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, and then coupled with the context of these jobs are so vital and they've often paid a lot of money to get there. It just, a lot of gaps for people to not mention it or to report.
So Rothna, let's bring you in. Louise mentioned the kafala system. It's something that we've talked about and explored on the show. And let's talk about the guardianship system that women are under in Qatar. Can you tell us about the legal measures and the fact that it's legally enforced and the limitations that it places on Qatari women?
Sure. So I documented how Qatar's laws, policies and practices require women to obtain male guardian permission, which could be their father, brother, uncle or grandfather, to give them permission in order to marry, study on government scholarships, work in many government jobs, travel abroad until they turn 25 years old or they get married, and to obtain certain forms of reproductive health care. And upon marriage, their husband becomes their male guardian. Now, just to give you a sense of the difference between men and women, men do not need any such permission as soon as they turn 18. And in fact, the law says anyone over the 18 doesn't need a guardian. So a lot of these policies that we see are completely in contradiction with Qatar's own constitution, which provides for equality before the law between men and women, as well as its own law that says guardianship should be set at 18. And I've documented how these rules actually impact women in a very intimate way across their entire lives. So women told me about how these rules meant that they couldn't lead independent lives. They needed to, and they, you know, when they were denied things like permission to drive, to travel abroad, study, work, or marry a person of their own choosing, this, you know, had a severe toll on them. They, you know, led to mental health harms. Some women talked about suicide ideation. Others just talked about how demeaning it was to be repeatedly expecting, even as an adult woman, to be seeking permission from their male guardians. And a lot of these rules are very odd. They happen at different times of their lives. So one woman who said she, you know, she was in her 30s and signing contracts, you know, she was working, she was a manager, she was signing all these business contracts. And she said she needed permission from her father to get a driving license. She's like, how is it that on the one hand, I'm signing contracts, and on the other hand, I have to go to my father for this permission? Yeah. And we have very, you know, lots of women who describe themselves as being quite privileged. You know, there are highly educated women in Qatar. Many of them have like broken barriers. You know, they would live very privileged, wealthy lives. You know, they would describe themselves in that way. But they found these rules to be quite demeaning and a threat that hang over them pretty much for the entire course of their lives. You know, they have to be, they're at the mercy of their male guardian. So if their father is very supportive, then, you know, they pretty much will get support to do whatever they want. But if they're not, or, you know, so they have an argument, you end up in a situation where you could be denied very much the regular things that, you know, people should be able to do. So just to give you another sense, you know, there was a woman called Fatima, who I'm calling Fatima, sorry, you know, it's a pseudonym. She said that, you know, she's estranged from her father. So her brother becomes her male guardian in that instance, her younger brother. And she needs to travel with her mother, which means that even though she's an adult woman, her mother's an adult woman, her brother needed to give her the permission as the sister to be able to travel abroad using what's known as an exit permit to leave the country. And she asked him to extend it because she needed want to continue to travel. And he said, well, no, I want to use this. I want to use it, the power, when he wants something from mom. So that's the way she kind of put it to me. It's the way that men can sort of take advantage of the power and authority that they're granted by the state. And so, you know, women have talked about how incredibly difficult these rules have been over their lives. And there is both a legal and a social reality. So even when things do change, so for instance, in January 2020, they did finally change the rule and allowed women who can to drive without needing male guardian permission. They can actually get the provisional driving licenses now. Some women said that, you know, even with that change, their families don't want them to drive. So their fathers will still deny them that, right? So there is still a social reality that takes longer to change. But what I found within this report and through my investigation is that what we're seeing right now in terms of the severe discrimination that women face is really directed by the authorities. They essentially have told men that they have authority and control over women and that they should get to decide what happens in women's lives. And so forevermore, you end up in this situation that women have to contend with men thinking that they should get to tell them what to do.
Yeah. And another question then for you, Roth, and off the back of that, do you think the World Cup has kind of put a spotlight on these issues? Because I know initially people were very hesitant about the World Cup taking place in Qatar, but actually issues have been raised and this potentially could be a huge turning point, particularly for women of the country.
What's interesting is that the past decade since Qatar got the World Cup, they did very little to actually change the situation for women. Like they just thought that no one was going to find out about it, that it would go away. It is a very closed society. So people don't generally want to talk about what's happening in the country. And I think they thought it was they could get away with it. And in essence, through my investigation, women actually came to speak about what was going on because they were hoping that if it gets out, then the authorities will be pushed to actually change something. Some of this. The sad fact is, even after the report, which is almost a year old now, the authorities haven't done very much to actually change the practices. They still will ignore it. They still deny what's actually going on the ground. Mm-hmm. And women still said to me, you know, they're hoping that through the World Cup, because of the level of attention, that the Qatari authorities can't ignore it, that the world is exposing what's happening to them right now. And they're hoping, so they do have hope. They're hoping that it will be positive, that in the end, they can't get away with this level of discrimination in both law and practice, and that it will force the authorities to try to move and change some of these rules for the better.
Football and sport, I think, is an unusual kind of cultural phenomenon in many ways, because it started, I think, for me, ignorantly, just as a football fan, looking and thinking when they had images of Qatari fans in the stands, thinking, where are all the female fans? That really struck me. And I think it almost seems kind of strange or counterintuitive that that's maybe the place that maybe progress starts to snowball, built on the amazing work that you've done. And hopefully seeing images like that will drive people to look at work that people like yourself have done. I think one of the things that I find very hard to understand is how you mentioned obviously that men and women are legally equal under the law. So how is this repressive system then still allowed to be in place? You said it comes directly from the authorities. How does that happen?
It happens because they have no way of actually to combat discrimination in practice, right? So we have, for instance, take the rule on the exit permits, the fact that a woman needs permission to travel abroad. That's not a law. That's an interior ministry policy. You can find it on their website. It's very clear. They have a mobile app to do that and everything. So there's an entire structure set up to be able to do this with no real legal basis for it. And yet the authorities continue to do it because when you look at the way the authorities are set up, you know, this is a monarchy, you know, not a monarchy. This is a ruling family that basically rules over this country. It is not a democracy, right? So they get their legitimacy from this society. And for them, the people that matter are the patriarchs, the men, right? They don't care about the women, even if the, you know, they owe their, you know, they should be responsible for everyone in their society. They only are caring for those that they think are mostly important to them, which is the men in the society. So what they're doing is essentially saying, okay, we'll give you the decision as the men to decide what is going to happen in the lives of your women, essentially, which means if you want to be a progressive man and have your daughter study abroad or marry the man of her choosing, you get to decide. But if you're a conservative man and you don't want your daughter to marry a certain man or study in a certain place or work in a certain job, you get to decide that. And we, the state, are going to back off with our hands and let you make those decisions. So when we see progression happening in the country, it is largely because women themselves are doing this. They're fighting with their own families. They're having to negotiate with the men. They're trying to sort of advance their careers with as much whatever they can to get that level of support to be able to advance it. Sometimes incredibly challenging circumstances. And there are incredibly amazing, talented women in this country who I've spoken to that are frustrated, that are being controlled, that can't advance where they want to go because they come from abusive and very controlling families. And the country and the authorities in this regard have done nothing for them there. And that's where the real suffering happens. You know, the authorities are not sort of wanting to sort of give up the control that they've allowed to these male guardians. And just to give you a sense, you know, we talked about kafala, which is the immigration sponsorship system. It's not that much different. What the country is essentially doing is saying, we're going to give the men control over women through what's known as the male guardianship system. And we're going to give employers control over migrant workers through the sponsorship system. So everyone gets to control other sets of humans. And the authority essentially is backing away and allowing abuses, enabling abuses to happen. When you look at the male guardianship system, it is a form of domestic violence. You are, if you control another person's life and deny them their rights, that is domestic violence. And the authorities have essentially allowed that to happen. They've enabled it to happen.
And like you say, if a female doesn't get on with her dad, or a female doesn't get on with her brother, or whoever becomes sort of her guardian in charge of what she's allowed to do, then it's game over. They must, you know, these women must feel so, so vulnerable. And Louise, do you think that FIFA are kind of, they're complicit in allowing these incidents against migrants working to take place? And do you think maybe that more should have been done to prevent women from being attacked?
So, I mean, when I went to FIFA with my, you know, allegations of women, you know, they kind of came back and said, you know, it was pretty standard response that, like, you know, they took allegations of misconduct extremely seriously and they had a clear process in place for anyone who wanted to report such incidences. I should say that Qatar authorities said something similar. You know, the women in my story and the experiences they face basically weren't the reality for the millions of female workers in the country, and that they want to protect the rights of all women in Qatar, including female workers. Of course, the reality for the women and the majority of the women I spoke to is that, you know, they often live in fear of reporting. You know, we've spoken about this. They don't want to lose those jobs. They're scared of being deported. So the testimonies of the women that I spoke to, as well as those of the experts who've kind of worked extensively with female hospitality workers in Qatar, suggest that few feel able to report sexual harassment should it occur. And so, yeah, I mean, FIFA has been told and it's been highlighted to them and it's been laid out. But yeah, it's ongoing. And I think steps have been put in place to try and help. But as we've heard, you know, a lot of those steps, like the auditing system in practice, is not doing what it needs to be done. So
Louise, is there a concern, I suppose, from your side that once the World Cup ends and kind of this big, huge global carnival rolls out of Qatar, that then FIFA just abdicate all the responsibilities and off they go, and there's even fewer options for these women?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that's like a continuous fear that everyone, like every human rights organization that has worked on this, is concerned about. I know that the Qatari government or the authorities said that they will be, they will be sort of focusing more intently on workers' violations throughout the tournament. But, you know, human rights groups say that this sort of creates a bubble where you're focusing very intently on migrant rights workers' violations in this month. And then once that's gone and the world's attention has moved on, then, you know, where does that leave migrant workers, and particularly where does that leave women? Because they face, you know, not only do they face everything that the male migrant workers face, which is the kafala system and everything that's wrapped up in that, you know, they face an extra layer of risk, I guess, because, you know, they're at high risk of sexual harassment, sexual abuse, gender-based violence, things like that. And whether that has sort of adequately been dealt with or thought about, I guess, yeah, remains to be seen.
Rothner, let's talk about domestic abuse and domestic violence, because it isn't criminalised in Qatar. Is that a significant issue? And I suppose what might a woman who is being abused do?
That's right. There is no domestic violence legislation in the country. They have what, you know, the regular criminal code provisions of assault. So if you've been hit on the street or hit anywhere else, you should be able to go to the police about it. But as we've sort of seen and as I've documented, when it comes to domestic violence, really the onus is on women who really face a lot of difficulties trying to get help and protection from the authorities. There is one shelter that exists in the country, but women who I've spoken to said it's incredibly difficult to get in. I haven't actually managed to find a woman who managed to get in. I've spoken to maybe one or two people who said they knew of a woman who did get accepted, but the vast majority said either they couldn't get into the shelter or they tried to help someone to get to a shelter and they struggled as well. I've spoken to women who've said, in fact, they went to the authorities to report domestic violence and found themselves being told, basically mediated to go back to their families, where the women were forced to sign pledges that they will do as their family tells them to do, and the family is told to sign pledges that they won't harm them with no real protection. So if they get taken home and then beaten, there's nothing that they're going to be able to do about it. Women have also talked about being forcibly admitted to the psychiatric institution. So there's a psychiatric hospital, and where women do end up, and the law allows them to have male guardians actually forcibly admit them to a psychiatric institution, where they can spend weeks detained, essentially, until a doctor finds that it's got nothing to do with their mental health. It's actually to do with the fact that the family wants them to marry someone they're refusing, or the woman simply wants to go out with her girlfriends and they think that's crazy. That's essentially what families think, and then they detain them in these institutions. I've also spoken to women who have been arrested by the authorities because the families reported them as a way of punishing them for believing that they're, you know, telling the authorities that they think they might be in a relationship. There isn't what's known as a community protection law, which is essentially allowing the authorities to detain anyone for potentially reasonably expecting that they might commit a moral crime. This is the law that's used to lock up women and men, including people of LGBT background. So the reporting that we've done around LGBT people, that's the law that's being used to detain people without charge or trial. And we've seen women being arrested under this. So domestic violence is an ongoing issue. It is the case in any country in the world. But the ways in which women are exposed to it is because the laws and practices in Qatar enable domestic violence. And then when women face it, the authorities back off and force them back to their abusive families, or even punish them through detaining them either in police stations or in psychiatric institutions.
Rothna, just finally, as we say, I mean, the World Cup ends on Sunday and off FIFA go. And so there's a lot of the media attention. I suppose in order to allow Qatari women to genuinely live their life freely and with genuine parity with men, and to have actual protection under the law, how practically can this aim be achieved?
I mean, I think it's really important to continue to talk about these issues because Qatari women came out and talked to me. And, you know, I spoke to 50 women. I did more than 73 interviews. But the 50 in-depth interviews with Qatari women who felt the importance of telling their stories to the world so that things can change. Mm. And if the World Cup's attention goes away, so does the potential chance for reforms in the country. And I want to be clear, this is one of the most conservative countries in the region. In some respects, they've become worse than Saudi Arabia, where everyone knows the situation is bad. And yet the authorities don't care. You know, they've done very little to change it. They don't want to be seen to be changing it. So it is important to keep talking about this issue. The World Cup might be going away, but the Qatari authorities, they want the Olympics. They want other big sporting events. They still want the world to come and visit its country. And we have to be clear, right? There's a series of discrimination that women face. There's Qatari women and what they face. There's the foreign national women. They face very similar issues to what Qatari women face because of the male, the sponsorship system. So if you're going as a wife or a daughter of somebody who's working in the country, you also can't drive or work or get a government scholarship without their permission. And if you're there as a migrant woman, then you face all sorts of problems similar to that, as well as the fact that you are exposed to other risks as well. So it's really important to recognize that Qatar is not a safe place for women, and that it's a place where women can face huge amounts of discrimination, potential domestic violence, and even sexual violence as well. And while that occurs in anywhere around the world, it is because of the authorities' laws and policies that leave women at risk. So we can see how easily changeable a lot of these things are. A number of the things I've documented, they could change tomorrow. It's not based in law. They can just switch their, you know, click their fingers and change it tomorrow. But the fact that they're not doing it shows the incredible disregard that they have for women's lives and security.
And I suppose from our point of view, I would just recommend people watching this, people listening to this, do seek out Louise and Rothner's work, share it. The more people that see it and share it, and the more educated everybody is, the more we can mobilize support once the World Cup goes away to try and do something about this situation. Rothner Begum, Louise Donovan, thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Thank you. So insightful.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Thank you very much for joining us. Okay, so it's time for the World Cup's funniest moments, where each episode we have a look at some of the more humorous moments from a very controversial World Cup. Right, now it's time to have a look at a moment that happened a couple of weeks ago, but we've been meaning to talk about. It's an Irish fan building some barriers across the ocean.
Je suis un baguette.
That's literally like GCSE French, isn't it? 10 minutes late to the class, to the lesson. Yes, we baguette. And your teacher's like, sit down.
Say an Irish fan building bridges, not building barriers across the ocean. I got myself very muddled there.
It's weird. I used to have an Irish French teacher. Can you imagine how confusing that is? She's called Madame Hartam. So when I went for my exam for GCSE French, I was like, bonjour, je m'appelle Hannah. And it was like... Because otherwise, I'd either do it in a Yorkshire accent, like bonjour, je m'appelle Hannah. But it was, in an Irish accent, and I failed, believe it or not.
But it is weird, that, isn't it? It's like there's just a couple of words that you just pick up, and they just kind of stay in your vocabulary forever. Yeah. Like I told you, didn't I, about I did Spanish for a couple of years at school,
right.
And all that has remained is donde está la biblioteca, cruce de playa de segunda, cruce de playa de segunda calle a la izquierda. It means, where's the library? Cross the square, it's the second street on the left.
But like, I bet you say that to girls in a pub, like in the past when you've been dating.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, but in the past. That's why I was careful what I said.
But you're absolutely right, Hannah. I did. That is, when I was down O'Shaughnessy Kingston in the old days, if I wasn't pretending to be a member of the Spurs youth team, I would sometimes pretend to be a member of the Real Madrid youth team, and that I was traveling, and that that I had a dual nationality, but that I'd signed for Real Madrid, and they'd be like, but you don't look like, you don't look Spanish. And I'd be like, Donde está la biblioteca, cruce de calle de like literally.
If anybody that I know in this entire world that would do something like that is you, and you would probably pull it off.
Right, okay, it's time for Tell Me Something I Don't Know. It's about exploring some of the most important aspects of football that rarely get discussed. And today we are talking on the use of technology in sport with Dr. Ryan Beale, CEO and co-founder at Sentient Sports. So Sentient Sports are a company that uses AI to improve decision-making in the sports industry. Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Joe and Hannah. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. But let's talk a little bit about what it is that Sentient Sports actually does, the data you collect, and how that helps the football experience.
Yep. So Sentient Sports has been using AI and advanced data analytics in the industry for a few years now, mainly focused on helping sort of professional sports teams and organizations improve their decision-making both on and off the pitch. So really this is focused on using AI for football teams to improve their recruitment. So we've used it to add forward-looking analytics to help them effectively predict what a player is going to do once they change teams. So many things change from the players they're playing with, the tactics, and it doesn't always mean a good player is right for every team. So we help them add this layer of forward-looking risk analytics and risk assurance when they're making these decisions.
So what are the key analytics that you look for then, for example, with a player? What are the things that you would look for?
So teamwork's a big thing for us. So yeah. We focus really heavily on how we can predict how humans are going to work together effectively. So this is where some of my research and my PhD focused, and it was all around how we can look at pairs of players contributing to the team. So a lot of traditional stats that you see on Match of the Day or the way that pundits talk about the game is individual performances, where actually football is a very team-based sport. It's all about how people work together. You can put the best players on the pitch and they might not be the best team if they've never played together before, don't speak the same languages, or they just don't complement each other's skills. So we add that forward-looking simulation aspect where we can simulate these new pairs of players working together, look at their languages, and then effectively predict how much they're going to impact in that new team.
That must be, that kind of data though, must be so kind of nuanced and subtle. How do you, how do you quantify and measure teamwork and the ability to work well in a team?
Yeah, so we built a model that can look at joint contribution of players that currently play together. So we can build sort of millions of these players across the whole world in leagues, sort of 100 plus leagues across the globe, really. By extracting all of these pairs, we can feed that into a neural network model that is able to pick up on all of these intricacies. So it can look at if they speak the same languages, how many games they've played together in the past at club or international level, and it can look at then how good they are effectively. So someone like Kevin De Bruyne will create lots of good pairs in a team, as you'd expect. And it can also get style as well. So we can effectively say if you've got a 6'4" centre forward and you're trying to sign a new midfielder, if he puts good balls into the box, that's going to be complementary skills. You've got someone who's good at heading, someone good at crossing. Those two things work well together. And it's trying to feed this information to clubs so they're able to effectively make decisions off the back of that.
I was just going to say, the question I would ask is how would you say this technology is more kind of successful than like your traditional football scout?
I think for me, scouting is it's an art, really. It's just really challenging to put any scout in terms of what means success. So many decisions are made for different reasons. You look at a club might sign 5 players in a window. One of those players might be a first team player who needs to come in and change a team as a striker and score goals, but some of them may be squad players. So actually backwards looking assessments of how scouts and AI perform is really challenging. So what we try and do is add that layer of human plus AI technology so they're able to evaluate their own decisions better and sort of add that objective assurance on top of a subjective decision. So we can back test and show that the AI has found players that have done well. It's not perfect, but I think it just adds that assurance level to really make sure that those objective decisions, you're not making a big mistake. And I think that's really important when you're making 20, 30 million pound decisions. And these are, this is what would happen in a normal business of the same size as football team. It's just football has got that subjective and almost art-driven format, which has been going on for over 100 years.
So that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's a complementary technology, not something that replaces scouting. Because I kind of assumed that would mean you don't need a traditional scout. But do you need people out there collecting the data in the first place, going to the games, watching the games, or I guess watching them on monitors or whatever? Yeah. I mean, how does that work, that initial data collection? Is that still human-driven?
It's moving away from that now. So traditionally, with companies like Prozone and Opta in the last 20 years, they've collected that data by tagging games after. So they would have watched the game, it's happened, they'll watch on video, they'll collect all the events that happened on the pitch and then feed that into companies like this or feed into the clubs themselves to then take that data and create analytics off the back of it. I think more and more now computer vision and that sort of technology is being used to automate this process and some companies will then spend more time doing human quality assurance on this data than others. And I think that then allows you to get big footprints across the globe where you don't need huge teams of humans watching games to collect this data. So we don't actually collect the data ourselves, but we'll leverage the data that other companies are collecting and then use this to sort of add that extra layer of analytics on the top of that.
Yeah, I think Joe was hoping you were going to say, actually, it's Smurfs. We get a team of Smurfs and they go on and collect all the data around all the football stadiums in the country.
Fairies, pixies and goblins, Joe. You know it. Yeah.
I knew it. Ryan, what do you reckon is the next great technological advance in football?
I think really it's the acceptance of data and AI. I think it's, for me, in any business and any sort of field at all, it's a combination of human and AI decision making. And I think that's where football needs to go. It needs to be that understanding that AI can be used to help make better decisions and it can be used to improve what humans are doing. It's not going to take your job. It's not going to replace the scouts. It can be used to make more efficient human decision making, and the combination of the two I think will be really, really powerful. And that's where football's going. There's not going to be a Moneyball moment where one stat is going to break football like it did in baseball. That's not the type of sport football is. It needs to be that combination of data, human, advanced technology together that's going to make a real difference.
Ryan, that's honestly potentially one of the most interesting 10 minutes of my life. How so late? Oh, that was absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on, Ryan. Honestly, genuinely fascinating stuff. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan.
Really nice to talk to you.
Dr. Ryan Beale, their CEO and co-founder at Sentient Sports. Okay, so that's it for today's show. We are going to be back with you after the semifinals this week. And we're going to be reviewing the tournament with Jack Jones from Trampoline. And our big conversation will be about the environmental impacts of the World Cup. That's going to put a spring in our step, isn't it, Hannah? Oh dear. Have you had a nice time?
I've had a lovely time. Have you, Joe?
It's been ever so good. I feel a little bit better about England going out now. Right. Thank you very much. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.